Ahab is muted.
Oh, here we go. Hi. Oh, now it works. Hi. Welcome to order. Welcome and thank you for coming to the Tuesday, August 21st, 2018 meeting of the Clark County Commission on Aging. To begin with, do we have any items to add to our agenda?
Yes, Madam Chair. I would like to add discussion and action, possible action on county changes to the manufactured housing and mobile home code update.
Do we have a second?
Second.
All in favor?
Aye.
Opposed? All right, we will add that to the agenda under new business and announcements. May I have a motion to approve, or is there anything else? Okay. May I have a motion to approve the agenda?
So moved.
Second? All in favor?
Aye.
Opposed? Passes. All right. And has everybody had a chance to review the minutes for July 17th?
Move to approve.
Second.
All in favor?
Aye.
Any opposed?
I wasn't here. I was absent.
All right. Marion will abstain. All right. And so now, next we have an update from the Area Agency on Aging and Disabilities of Southwest Washington.
Thank you. Two things I learned at the recent Area Agency meeting. One, I wanted to highlight here, the Alzheimer's Walk on September 9th. It is at Esther Short Park. And for more information, you can just Google Alzheimer's Walk, Esther Short Park. It's on September 9th. Also, gentleman was there who's in the audience, Arnold Dar, described something called Sheds for Men, S-H-E-D. It was an organization started in Australia. There's 11 of them in the United States. They're 501c3s. The purpose of these groups for men is that they have a gathering place to talk and interact with each other over doing something. So I just wanted to highlight that. Each of the commission members has a copy of it. And Arnold might want to say something about it. I don't know. Okay, good. It folds in with our recommendation last year. One of the things that we as a commission wanted to highlight and keep an eye on and do what we can about is the high suicide rate in older men. And this is something that would combat that. Thank you.
Great. Thank you, Marjorie. And up next, we have our presentation from Dr. Jennifer Dill. And just by way of some introduction, we're going to hear about active transportation. Walking and biking can contribute to healthy aging by improving mobility, access to services, and physical and mental health. Developing well-connected, attractive bike and pedestrian networks that are safe, convenient, and user-friendly for people of all ages and abilities will help people get where they need to go while also helping the environment and the economy. Jennifer Dill is a professor of urban studies and planning at PSU and director of PSU's Transportation Research and Education Center, and she is here to discuss with us the benefits of active transportation. Please welcome Jennifer.
Thank you. Hopefully I'm close enough to this that it's going to be working. I'm really happy that you invited me here today. I have been at PSU as a professor and doing transportation research and teaching for about 17 years now, and I focus a lot on bicycling and walking, and have done a lot of research gathering data on that. And I've collaborated a bit with my colleagues at the Institute on Aging at PSU, and I know you had Alan De La Torre come a few weeks ago to kick off this series. And it is a topic that I'm quite interested in, and preparing this talk gave me an opportunity to dive into the research a bit more to find out what's going on and what have we learned and what do we know about this topic. I will say I was a little disappointed that there isn't a whole lot of good research out there about specific programs and other sort of interventions to increase walking and bicycling among older adults. I'll present some ideas, but I'm hoping this is having the opportunity to prepare this presentation. I want to dive in even more, and I'm quite interested to see where you guys take this next in terms of activities between your commission and the Ped Bike Advisory Commission, and what you might be doing up here in Clark County and how we might partner on where you might go with this. So without further ado, this picture, obviously, you probably look at it and it doesn't look like, it's definitely not Portland, Oregon. I was on vacation in Milan, Italy, and I happened to spot this lovely woman on her bike in a very stylish part of Milan, and it just, I loved the image and the thought of it, and so included it here. So, benefits of physical activity broadly, but biking and walking. Walking is the most common form of physical activity for older adults, and bicycling far less so. But in terms of the benefits of physical activity, including biking and walking, for older adults, there's very, very strong evidence of the benefits, and I'm guessing that your commissioners and many people in the audience are very familiar with this already, but strong evidence in terms of reducing a full range of things, ranging from, I would say most importantly, morbidity and mortality, but also obesity, diabetes, some forms of cancer, chronic pain, risk of falls, depression, mental health, all sorts of positive health benefits of physical activity for older adults. And conversely, the flip side of that, evidence that regular physical activity can definitely improve living independently, quality of life, well-being, physical function and cognitive function, and obviously just overall health. So the evidence is very clear. I mean, I think we all know that, right? That getting more physical activity is going to help our health at all ages. So what exactly does help? How much physical activity do we want? The Centers for Disease Control recommends 150 minutes of moderate activity, such as brisk walking, per week, and muscle strengthening two times a week. This is the recommendation for both older and younger adults. Or alternatively, if you want to go faster than brisk walking, 75 minutes of vigorous activity. But I usually focus on that 150 minutes of moderate activity, because that's going to be more typical for most people, including of all ages. And the important thing to keep in mind is that as little as 10 minutes of that moderate activity is beneficial. So you don't have to go out there and, you know, take an hour-long walk or even a half-hour walk. A 10-minute walk is going to sort of count towards your 150 minutes a week. And definitely walking, like I said, is the most common way that older adults meet that 150 minutes and get that activity. Bicycling is another way, and I'll talk more about that. And then I included here a picture of transit, because when you think about 10 minutes, a 10-minute walk to the bus stop would get you, you know, your 10 minutes. So one bus trip a day, 10 minutes on each end, you could be getting your 20 minutes of physical activity. And so when we talk about active transportation, we often include walking, biking, and transit in active transportation, because in most cases you have to walk on one end of the trip or the other. So how many of us get those 150 minutes? I know I don't always. I see hands going up. Excellent. And actually, so these data, the blue bars are for the United States as a whole, and the orange-red bars are for the state of Washington. So the state of Washington is doing better than the nation as a whole, which I probably could have predicted before I pulled the data. And what might surprise some people is that the share of people who report that they are getting 150 minutes a week actually increases as adult age, particularly from sort of the 25 to 44, and you can see it going up, and actually adults 65 and older are the most likely of all adults to be making or meeting that 150 minutes. And in Washington, that's about two-thirds of adults. Now, the one, so that's good news. And these data are for 2015. I looked at the data for 2011, and particularly for 65 and older, the number was lower. It was around, I think, 61%. So it's been improving over the past few years, which is also a good sign. A couple things, I mean, this is good news, that two-thirds are meeting that, or at least they're saying they're meeting it. And so that's one word of caution with these data, is that it's largely based on surveys where you ask people how many minutes did you do, did you walk, how many minutes did you jog. And I don't know about you, but I know I would maybe overestimate a little bit. So that's an important thing to remember. And also there's clearly at least a third of older adults who are not meeting that recommended level. So walking and bicycling are two ways for older adults and all adults to be getting some of that physical activity. So what do we know about the rates of bicycling and walking in the U.S.? So these data are for the nation as a whole, and it's from 2017, so it's pretty new data. And the one thing particularly about bicycling is that it's a rare activity. And so these data are asking in the past 7 days, did you either make a trip by walking or by bicycling? And that would include if you walked to the store or if you just went out and walked the dog and came back, that would count as a trip. Or went for a bike ride and came back, or bike to work or bike to the store, whatever. Any of those things would count as a trip. And what you can see here, and I will risk, it worked, okay. That for the most part, you know, a large share of American adults are walking, at least have walked somewhere in the past week, at least once, fairly low bar, but still. And it drops off not a whole lot in the 65 to 74 category, but then it starts dropping off 75 and 85. And obviously, as people age, you know, physical limitations are going to be part of that, but there's other reasons as well. You can see bicycling, it's a different story. I'm curious, how many of you have ridden a bike in the past 7 days? Wow. Oh, my gosh. Well, it's a self-selected group that came to a talk about walking and bicycling, right? I confess I have not ridden a bike in the past 7 days. And so you can see you guys are definitely not representative of the American public because at most we're talking 10% of adults, but when you hit 65, it's dropping down to 6% and then 2% and 1%. So drop-off definitely in bicycling as people age in the U.S. at least. And then as I dug into these data a bit further, one thing that I think is important to remember when we're talking about older adults, as a transportation researcher, I'm often thinking about transportation and travel behavior as what we call a derived demand. In other words, I travel, I ride my bike, I walk, I drive because I want to get someplace else, right? I usually don't drive just because I feel like driving. And so we often think of that as utilitarian travel because there's some utility to me getting. I drove here today because to give this talk. I went to work, I went to the grocery store, whatever. And we sort of contrast that with what I often refer to as just recreational, just going out for a walk, going out for a bike ride, just for pure fun, no destination in mind. I'm just doing it mainly to get that physical activity. And so the data that are collected in the survey collect both types of travel that people are doing. whether it's for recreation or utility. And when I look at the data for older adults, 65 and older in particular, in terms of walking, about half of the walking that the older adults are doing is for pure recreation, getting some exercise, and about half of it is to make a trip, to go somewhere, to get to a grocery store or to visit friends or something like that. Bicycling, on the other hand, is almost, amongst older adults, is primarily a recreational activity. Very few of the bicycling activity right now in the U.S. that older adults are doing is for sort of transportation-type purposes. So I think that's important to keep in mind when we're planning either programs or facilities for older adults for either biking or walking, whether or not people are doing it to get to a destination or if they're just doing it for fun will influence how we plan and what we might want to do. Digging into the data a little bit on gender, and this is a topic that I've focused on quite a bit in terms of bicycling. In general, women, no matter what age, girls and women do not bike as much as boys and men, in the U.S. at least. And you can definitely see that in these slides I focused in on 55 and older in terms of gender differences. Whoops. In terms of gender differences. And you can see women are far less likely to bike than men. And then in terms of walking, we don't see much of a difference from, you know, from 55 to 74. And then 75 and older is where you see women's rates of walking dropping off more so than men. And then one last way that I looked at the data, it's a little hard to see the exact numbers, but this is by housing density. And so we always want to think about the context of where we are planning and what we're looking at. And there's big differences between New York City and Vancouver and other cities in Clark and communities within Clark County. And so what I've highlighted here, this range is sort of the range of housing density that you would see in Clark County. My conclusion is sort of density can definitely help, but it's certainly not required in order to have people walking and bicycling in their neighborhood. And there really isn't much of a difference in this range, and I'd say sort of the range of density that you have in this area in terms of walking for older adults. And then in terms of bicycling, it doesn't really make a difference and for older adults. And part of the reason for that is that most of that biking is for recreational reasons. So density is important if you need to get to a destination, right? You want to get to a grocery store, it has to be close enough to walk or bike, right? Well, if you're just going out there to ride a bike for fun, then it doesn't really matter how close the grocery store is. So that's one reason density doesn't make much of a difference in terms of bicycling rates amongst older adults. So the data I've shown so far is for the U.S., and I always like to contrast. And we see in the U.S. walking rates are fairly high. These data are just for bicycling rates in other countries. The numbers are a little different because the measure is a little different. But the important point here, we have the U.S. and the U.K. compared to Germany, Denmark, and the Netherlands. The first bar is kids. Kids always bike more than adults. And then the next bars are different age groups, and the last one being 65. Well, it varies depending on the survey. But the last one or two bars are people who are 65 or 60 and older. And the important thing to note here is that in these countries, bicycling rates generally do not drop off with age, at least once you get past sort of teenage years. And there's a few different reasons for that, but one of the reasons is that the infrastructure is really great for bicycling. It is safe. People feel comfortable bicycling. And that's also why in these same countries, men and women bike at the same rates. And so because it's a very comfortable safe biking environment. Now, also, there's something to be said for the history of it, in that when people are biking as a young adult and a medium adult, young adult, in between adult, middle-aged, that's the word, middle-aged adult, then they may just continue on biking. So some of it is sort of a history of doing this for a few decades, but the infrastructure is key. And I always like to point this out because, and I have a similar slide that shows gender differences and no gender differences in these countries, because it's important to remember, it's like, it isn't something, you know, women don't bike because of a physical thing. There's nothing, it's because of different attitudes. We don't feel as safe biking in different environments and things like that. And the same thing with older adults. Now, there are some physical limitations as we age that can limit our bicycling, but I'll talk about that in a little bit, that there are actually some solutions for that as well. Okay, so what can we do to increase our rates of walking and bicycling amongst older adults? So there's pretty good research out there about why older adults don't walk and bike, and particularly in their neighborhood. And what I've highlighted here is sort of what the research, what there's evidence of in terms of barriers or things that influence whether or not older adults walk and bike. And some things apply to all ages, and some things are more specific to older adults. So traffic applies for both walking and bicycling. And for bicycling in particular, traffic and sort of fear of getting hit by a car is usually the biggest barrier for riding a bike. And that's true for all ages, but particularly older adults. Having destinations nearby, because you're only going to walk or bike so far. So that's a very common barrier for all ages. A little less so, again, on the bicycling, because often older adults are bicycling not to a destination. Some other things that are important, I'll focus on the walking side. Fall hazards, which are a bigger concern for older adults, which relates also to sidewalk quality. That's definitely, sidewalk quality is one potential cause of a fall. Perception of crime is a definite barrier for older adults in walking. Having safe crossings, this is a barrier for everyone of all ages, and particular older adults. And then sufficient crossing time at a signalized intersection in particular, because older adults tend to walk slower than younger adults, and so they need enough time to cross the street before the light turns red. Scenery, so having something interesting while you're out there, and then also places to stop and rest, and that's a particular concern to many older adults. On the bicycling side, safety fears, in addition to traffic, sort of other safety fears, are a barrier. And then lack of a bike. Most older adults don't necessarily even own a functioning bike, so if you don't own a bike, it's a little hard to ride a bike. And lack of experience or confidence bicycling. When you think about it, if only 10% of middle-aged adults have ridden a bike in the past week, that means, you know, 90% haven't been riding a bike, and then, you know, you can go many, many years before you would ever ride a bike again. So just that lack of experience is a big barrier. Okay, I'm going to jump into sort of some things that can help overcome that list of barriers. And I wanted to highlight a couple resources before I jump in, because I used in particular this book that came out from the Federal Highway Administration called Small Town and Rural Multimodal Networks. It was actually written by a consulting firm that's based in Portland, Oregon, but the examples are from all over the country, and it's available free online, and I grabbed a lot of pictures from it, you'll see. But it provides some great examples I think would be applicable to a lot of areas within Clark County. And then sort of on the other end of the spectrum, the National Association of City Transportation Officials, NACTO, has a whole set of guidebooks. These are more like design guidebooks on how to design streets and bikeways and things like that, that can definitely be applicable to many contexts in Clark County. And then I think you've already probably looked at the AARP Livable Communities resources, but a wealth of wonderful resources that would be supportive of this. And then another organization I like to point to is called 8 to 80 Cities. And the whole idea behind the organization is that they want to design cities of all sizes, small and large, where people from 8 years old to 80 years old, and actually beyond that, but, you know, 8 to 80 is a little more catchy than 6 to 96 or whatever. So they really focus on that all ages. And a lot of cities are adopting sort of, either 8 to 80s or all ages, all abilities as sort of a framework for thinking about bicycle and pedestrian planning. Okay. So what are some of the key elements that are important? I think basic sidewalks serve a no-brainer. That's why I don't have a whole lot on this slide, because I think it's pretty obvious, and there's very good standards out there about how to design good sidewalks to be wide enough and not too steep and things like that. A few things to keep in mind is sidewalk maintenance is very important. So having a good sidewalk maintenance program to repair cracks, et cetera, I think is really important. And then I think just about every transportation professor has great slides of like, or examples of photos like this where sidewalks just sort of end for no good reason. Always have to throw one in. Okay, so getting beyond that, and the types of infrastructure I'm talking about in these slides really focus on separation. So separating pedestrians and bicyclists from motor vehicle traffic. Because what we find is that most adults, and older adults included, don't want to mix with motor vehicle traffic for very good reasons. And so shared use paths or side paths are very common investments that a lot of cities make. I grabbed at least one photo from a path in the city of Vancouver. I think we all sort of know what this is, what we call a shared use path. So pedestrians and bicyclists and rollerbladers and et cetera can use it. A side path is basically the same thing, but it's right adjacent to a road with landscaping or something in between. But for the most part, it functions very similarly. And this is one example of a side path, for example, in South Lake Tahoe, which is, you can tell, a little more. The city of South Lake Tahoe is actually pretty busy with tourism, but this is right outside where it's a bit more forested. So these types of facilities are great. A few things to keep in mind for older adults, though. There's research that shows older adults are going to be more likely to walk in places where there are other people. So when I grabbed this photo of this one, I looked at that and I go, oh. I'll confess, I have not ridden on this path in Vancouver, so I don't know what the whole thing looks like. But it could be perceived as a little isolated. And so that's something to think about in terms of separate paths. And then this example down here I think is great because it's a little hard to see, but there is a bench added here, which is a great addition. Okay, protected bike lanes. So the one thing about shared use paths, they're great. They're wonderful. People love them. It's where people usually feel most comfortable riding a bike. People love to walk on them. You get some issues with some people biking too fast and things like that, but for the most part, people love them, but it's often difficult to build them. They can either be expensive or you may not have room. There may not be a place to build them. So some other alternatives for bicycling are what we call protected bike lanes. And I don't know if Vancouver, I don't know if there are any in Clark County yet. Oh, okay, excellent. Sorry, I haven't kept up. And the whole idea is this is an on-street bike lane, but there's some sort of separation and protection between the motor vehicles and the people on bicycles. And a few examples here, this is sort of a painted buffer and then having what we call flex post, a little curb, planters, parked cars, a curb, a barrier. So something vertical that separates the people on bikes from the people driving cars. These are becoming very, very popular across the U.S. and they're being built in all sorts of places. I mean, definitely it's sort of famous in New York City and Washington, D.C., but there are examples in a wide range of cities of where these are being built. They're popping up all over the place. This is in Jackson Hole, Wyoming. This is a really nice one. It's a one-way, and there's a curb here is what's separating from the rest of the street. This is in Austin, Texas. This was one that we actually did some research and evaluation on. It's in a more suburban area in Austin, Texas. You can see it's primarily single-family detached homes where they built. This is a two-way, and it's just with paint and flex posts is what's separating it from the cars. This is a pretty recent example in Phoenix, Arizona, in a more suburban environment. So they can work in any type of environment. And then the other type of bicycle infrastructure that I'm a big fan of is what generally we call bicycle boulevards. The city of Portland is now calling them neighborhood greenways. But if you look in guidance documents and across the U.S., we usually call it a bicycle boulevard. I'll just pause. Is anyone familiar with this? I always like to just double check to know. If you guys know all this stuff already, I can stop. But a few of you do, most of you don't. The whole idea behind a bicycle boulevard is to take an existing low traffic street, a neighborhood street, often single family home neighborhood, and use traffic calming devices to reduce the speed of the motor vehicles and to reduce the volume of motor vehicles. But you're already starting with a pretty low level of traffic, maybe 1,000 cars a day, which is not very much. And the whole idea is that with having fewer cars and slower cars on the street, a person on a bike can just bike in the middle of the street, and they're rarely going to encounter a motor vehicle. And when I live in Portland, Oregon, and I obviously work at PSU downtown, when I do ride my bike to campus, most of my ride is on a bike boulevard. And it is so nice because I don't have to think. Like, odds are I'm not going to see a car. Because the only reason you would drive on a bike boulevard, if it's designed well, is if you live and your destination is on that street. Because what it does is, first of all, you might include some of these speed humps that are very, you know, you could, in a car, you can go over them at like 20 miles an hour without a problem, but sort of annoying. You might have a diverter like this so that a car has to turn off of it or it can't turn onto the street. You might do these not very often. You might have a traffic circle like this that would slow cars down. You do stop signs in this direction, so cars, you know, you're not worried about cross traffic. And it just makes for a very pleasant riding environment. We've done a lot of research on these in Portland because the city has invested in them quite a bit. And we have found that they make a difference. They definitely encourage more people to ride bikes, and in particular, women. And the research we did was for families. So the adults that we were looking at were, 25 to 50 years old or so. But what we found is that for women, bipolar boulevards made up the difference. In other words, there wasn't a gender gap anymore if they had bike boulevards available to them. So it's definitely a strategy I recommend looking at, and they're relatively low cost, especially compared to like building a whole new shared use path, for example. Some examples I was able to find, because again, this is something that can be built in any type of a community. It doesn't matter. It doesn't have to be a big city or very dense at all. And like I said, most of these, usually you want it on sort of a quiet residential street. Ellensburg, Washington installed one fairly recently. I can't remember the date. This is an example. It's a little hard to see, but it's at an intersection, and the boulevard is going this way. And you can see that bikes, there's a little cutout in the curb there. So bikes can go through, but if a car would have to turn and get off the boulevard and drive someplace else. So that's how you reduce the number of cars on the street. This is an example in Arcata, California, which is on sort of the north, sort of near Humboldt in Northern California. This is an example similar to this in San Luis Obispo. Again, this is sort of a diverter. And so there's a lot of good guidance on how to build and design bicycle boulevards. I'm a huge fan. We've also have done some research that shows they can increase property values on the streets because they become very nice streets. They're also good streets for walking because you can imagine fewer cars, slower cars is quite nice. And a lot of people get worried about, oh, well, if the cars aren't driving on that street, are they going to drive on the other street? And for the most part, if they're designed well, it's not the sort of diversion of traffic doesn't become a big problem because you're starting with a low traffic street anyway. So there's not that many cars that are being diverted to other streets and they get dispersed. So for the most part, it's not a big problem. The other thing to keep in mind is connectivity and connected networks. And this is particularly important when you're walking or bicycling for transportation to get to a destination, because most of us want to do that in as short as time as we can. And so a well-connected network of paths or streets or whatever is going to help reduce your travel distance and travel time. So something to really think about, in particular if you have neighborhoods that have a lot of cul-de-sacs and dead ends, to be thinking about using short connected paths, so just for pedestrians and bicycles, that would connect the end of a cul-de-sac, in this example, to a shared use path, but maybe to a street that connects to other places, because otherwise it takes a long time to get places when you have a lot of cul-de-sacs. Okay. Okay. Safer crossings. This is really important for everyone, but particularly older adults, as I already mentioned. On average, older adults are walking slower than younger adults. Obviously, there's exceptions to that. So lots of things that we want to think about at crossings. Having ramps at crossings, which is obviously becoming more standard as we talk about accessibility for people with mobility devices. Some other things to do is to reduce crossing distances. Okay, so making it shorter to cross the street by using what we will often call a bulb out. This is a good example of one. You're still walking the same distance, but the amount of time that you're crossing the street is going to be shorter. And so this is a nice example. There's probably, I'm sure there's examples of this around downtown Vancouver and other neighborhoods around here. The other thing that this does, in addition to reducing this crossing distance, is that it slows the car down because it's a tighter turn and it's a narrower turn. And so the driver is going to slow down to make that turn. which relates to this idea, which is what we call curb radii. And if you could sort of picture a circle that fits that curve versus this curve, that's when we're talking about curb radii. And if we tighten up this radii, it's going to, again, the car is going to have to go slower to make that turn. I mean, as drivers, I think we all know if it's like this, I can make that turn really fast. If it's tight, I'm going to have to go slower. So those are things that are going to slow down traffic, be safer for pedestrians, gives the driver more time to see a pedestrian, and they're going to be going slower, and it's going to be easier to stop if they see a pedestrian. So that's a common technique that's used. Rectangular rapid flash beacons, this is sort of the most common design of these right now. And these would be used at often at a mid-block crosswalk or even a crosswalk in an intersection. How many of you have seen or used one of these? A few of you, yeah. They generally work very well. Drivers see the flashing lights and they stop and let people cross, and it's a pretty fairly low-cost way. The other thing that I'm a big proponent of is what we call the leading pedestrian interval. So this is at a signalized intersection where you do have pedestrian signals, and what this does is the pedestrian signal would turn on at least 3 or more seconds before the green light for the cars. So it gives the pedestrian an extra few seconds to start crossing the street. And this has been proven, a lot of good evidence out there, of the safety benefits, that it reduces pedestrian collisions at intersections. And so it's pretty low cost, easy thing that your traffic engineers can implement at just about any signal. And something that can definitely be considered. And one thing to think about is if you have neighborhoods that have, in particular, higher shares of older adults living in a neighborhood who will be crossing the street, I think that's a really good tactic to use and very, very inexpensive. Oh, the other thing I want to make sure is timing the pedestrian signal. A lot of our pedestrian signals are timed for the average adult walker, which is relatively fast, and so again, thinking about allowing more time for that pedestrian phase of the signal. Which relates to reducing traffic speeds, and I'm not going to go into in-depth about all the different ways you can reduce traffic speeds. I just want to make the case to really think about reducing traffic speeds. And because this graph is a good indicator of what happens. If a car hits a person and if the car is going 25 miles an hour, there's an 89% chance of survival. This is on average across all ages. As speeds go up, we get up to 45 miles an hour, and there's only a 35% chance of survival. And so particularly in residential areas and places where you're going to have a lot of people or you hope to have a lot of people walking and bicycling, to really think about controlling speed. And I know that we all want to get places faster and we get annoyed when we're stuck in traffic and all of that. But I think I would hope that people's lives are more important than a few seconds, takes you a few seconds longer to get places. So I think there's huge safety benefits from reducing speeds. So it's definitely a strategy to think about. Scenery and facilities, I think this is pretty obvious. You know, I think we know landscaping, artwork, there's all sorts of things that can improve scenery. Also making sure we maintain things, reduce graffiti, all those types of things. A few good examples of providing benches in places. I was giving this is my day for talking. I was giving a talk earlier on campus to a bunch of people we have from throughout the country, and we talked a bit about benches, and one of the, I don't know what city they work for, said that the, whatever other agency in the city didn't want to put in benches because along a new trail or something like that because they're afraid that it'll attract homeless people. And it's like, well, there's other ways you can deal with that issue. It's not always a simple solution. But I want to encourage us all to, like, not just say no to things that would be very beneficial to our residents and our community just because we're afraid that something bad might happen. Okay. Talked a lot about sort of the infrastructure. Going to segue more directly for biking. At least walking is pretty easy. You need, shoes. So there isn't a whole lot of sort of technology. Maybe some walking sticks. But it's fairly straightforward. But bicycles are a bit different. Obviously, if you're going to ride a bike, you need a bike to be able to ride. And, a lot of us grew up in time where there was just one type. I know when I was growing up, it was like the 10-speed with the drop handles. I mean, when I thought of a bike, that's what you thought of as a bike. And then I hadn't ridden a bike for a long time, and I ended up in Portland, Oregon. I think, I should ride a bike. And, I'm now in my 40s, and it's like, I'm not going to ride that kind of bike, and I need a different kind of bike. And luckily, there are lots of different kinds of bikes available now, and a couple that I want to talk about in particular, electric assist bikes. And this is just one example. There's all sorts. This one actually is sold by Walmart, and this is the battery here. And you can see it's a step-through frame. It's a very nice, upright bike. Electric assist bikes, let me ask you, has anyone ever ridden one? Ooh, I see one. I see a couple. Did you enjoy it? Anyone own one? No? You've just ridden one. The idea behind electric assist bike is, first of all, you do still have to pedal, okay? It's not like a electric moped, or it's not like the ones you see if you've been to China and you see the e-bikes there where people just sit on them. You do have to pedal. It's not going to go if you're not pedaling. But what the electric motor does is it gives you a little bit of extra power, and you can control how much extra power you get. It's really helpful, obviously, going up a hill. It's also very helpful starting. If you're a law-abiding bicyclist and you stop at a stop sign, you know how much effort it is to, like, get started again. And that's why a lot of cyclists don't stop at stop signs, which isn't good. The e-assist gives you just a little bit of, it's really easy to get started again. We've at Portland State, we've done a lot of research on e-bikes. We just completed our second national survey of e-bike owners where we surveyed over 1,600 e-bike owners from throughout the whole U.S. And one thing that we found is 28% were owned by people 55 to 64, 19% of them were owned or 19% of the people that we surveyed, I should say, were 65 or older. So high rates of adoption amongst older adults. And I just included a couple quotes here that came from some of our survey respondents that I think are really nice examples of why e-bikes, I think, are very attractive and a great solution for older adults. So this one is a 64-year-old retired person. It is a new and exciting experience to ride along the gorgeous dedicated bike path near the Sacramento River where I live. I don't give up and feel too exhausted trying to bike up the hills. A second respondent, I'm 63 years old and have had 3 knee surgeries and cardiac bypass. Having an e-bike enables me to ride more often than I would on my regular bike. You need to understand how beneficial e-bikes are to us as we get older. And there were numerous quotes like that. I think they're a really great solution for lots of people, and particularly older adults. We did a research project with Kaiser Permanente out in Clackamas County, where we loaned e-bikes to Kaiser employees to use for a few weeks to sort of test them out. And that was a good example, and several of them did end up adopting, buying their own e-bike afterwards. So that idea of giving loaning a bike like this to someone to test out, I think is a good idea. And then I also, these are a few examples of what you might call an adult tricycle. There's a full range of types of these vehicles. Some are more recumbent, some are much more upright, a full range of them. And there's been a few programs, not as many when I went searching, not as many as I would like. The city of Portland did one program a few years ago. They did it for a few years, but they haven't done it for the past, I think, 3 years, where they had several of these lower style tricycles, and they had a program for older adults. It was like a 1 or 2 hour program that they did. In this case, you can see along a pathway where people would just try them out, learn to ride them, feel comfortable with them for a couple hours, and get introduced to them. In Honolulu, Hawaii, there's a bike club that does this on a regular basis. But there aren't a whole lot of examples of these programs, but I think it's definitely a great idea. Which leads me to this sort of last slide of ideas and things. And this is under a large category of what I call encouragement programs. I focused a lot on the infrastructure. You know, we need safe infrastructure so people feel comfortable walking and bicycling. But that's often not enough. To get people to change their behavior. When we're talking about behavior change, it's hard, no matter what we're trying to do differently than what we used to do. And so there's a full range of programs that can work. So skills training, there's a fair number of examples here and there across the country of cities through either recreation departments or other agencies that do sort of skills training for older adult bicycling, mentoring or buddy programs for both walking and bicycling, group rides, group walks, bike loan or test programs, or like what I mentioned we did with Kaiser. And then a couple other things, walk audits, and you can also do bike audits. I mentioned the walk audits because ARP has a very nice walk audit toolkit. So that's something to do at the early stages to go out and involve your commission, other members of the community to go out there and do an audit of a neighborhood to really identify what works and what doesn't work and what can we improve. And then open streets events where you close down some streets and just let everyone walk and bike up and down the streets. I think Vancouver has done that, or maybe not? Yeah, I thought so. Okay, so in Portland, it's called Sunday Parkways. Lots of cities are doing them. It's just a way to get people out there thinking about, oh, maybe I could be walking and bicycling in my neighborhood. So a few final thoughts that I had after I went through all of this and put it all together. And my first one is, this isn't rocket science, okay? Everything that I've shown you, paths, these encouragement programs, I mean, e-bikes are new, sort of new. It's not rocket science. They're pretty fairly, in many ways, simple. These are tools in the toolbox that transportation planners and engineers have had for a while. We sort of know that these things can work. So it's not rocket science in terms of what the solutions are. And then I put in parentheses perhaps political science, because my experience has been it usually takes some leadership and some political will to do these things. You often need funding, or you need the traffic engineer has to change the way he or she does things, or you have to convince Public Works, or you have to partner with another agency. It's usually the political will and the organizing that's the key factor that makes a difference between the places that implement these things and don't implement them. Funding is important, but there's a lot of low-cost solutions in there. And again, the funding is also a political decision in terms of making a commitment to these things. The benefits are great. I've focused here on some of the solutions that I think are particularly important for older adults. I've skipped some other options that I didn't think would be as effective for older adults. But the benefits extend to all ages, and they go beyond just health benefits. There's growing amount of evidence that these things can improve property values and the economic vitality of neighborhoods and regions. Plans and policies are important, so your bicycle and pedestrian plan for the county, your transportation plan, that's where these things need to be included in order to be implemented. Involving the community is always important because you want to listen to people in your community to understand. I've given you, in some ways, a somewhat generic list of here's the things to do. It's important to talk with your community in different neighborhoods to figure out exactly what's going to work where. Multimodal is really important, so particularly with your transit system, so giving people options to maybe walk one way, take transit the other way, things like that. And then I added in this question about new modes, because if you haven't been in Portland lately, we now have these electric scooters. We've had them for, I don't know, maybe a month now. I don't know if they've been threatening to come up here to Clark County yet or not. But this picture is actually from San Jose, California, but I happen to be walking down there where they have them. And they're brand new. There's no research about these things. I have no idea. But I put it on here because I started to wonder, like, is that a good option for older adults? Because the young kids are out there riding them all over the place. And it just got me thinking about there's probably some other new modes of transportation that are coming out that will give all of us and perhaps older adults another option. So I'll leave that and answer questions.
Do we have questions from the commission? Marjorie?
How much are the electric bikes?
Oh, electric bikes. Cost of electric bikes. So they really range. I think that one at Walmart was around $500. There are definitely more expensive ones. If you're in the market for one, I don't recommend going too cheap.
Yeah.
And it's $1,200, yeah.
And second question, the other countries where there's not a drop-off for people riding a bike in terms of age, is their infrastructure a lot different?
Yes, it's a lot different. And it's primarily separated. I would describe it as the protected bike lanes. So it's in most of those in the large cities, on just about every major street, you would have a protected bike lane along the street in both directions. So it's separated infrastructure or things similar to the bike boulevards, but they have different terminology for them. So yes, and again, it's that separating the modes is the big thing.
Thank you.
Chuck and then Larry.
So first of all, Professor Jill, thank you. That was very educational and appreciated it. We've been having a discussion about alternative ways to get around once you give up your driver's license. And one of those we've talked about is the bike sharing that we see, like Bike Town.
Yeah.
And so I was curious, are there anything, examples of like Trike Town?
Yeah, okay. So Bike Town did have what they called adaptive bikes. And I'll be honest, I never saw them, so I don't know what kind of bikes they used. And then I do know there are a handful of examples throughout the country of bike share systems that have used like the tricycle type bikes in their bike share program. So it's definitely been done. And I will also say I don't know the one in Portland. Like, I don't know how well it turned out. But that's definitely an option to consider. The bikes exist. It's possible to do it. Yeah. I think another thing to think about is maybe having such bikes available, let's say, at senior centers or at parks department, you know, or maybe some different locations throughout the community. Because the other thing is, if you just want to loan them out for people to go for a bike ride, it may just be that they want to go out and ride and come back. And so that might be an option short of doing a whole bike sharing program.
This is enjoyable and very informative. I often wonder, when you look at statistics, you look at two types of bikers, those that rely on bikes to get to work. It's their transportation. And then you have another category, which I call the recreational bikers. And they're two different. One has a different viewpoint when it comes to the option. One does not have a choice because they pick bikes to get to work because they cannot afford a car, or that's the only alternative. Have you looked at some of the data on that as far as the use of transportation?
Yeah, there are often people, adults in the U.S., who only bike for recreation. They go out mountain biking, they ride on trails, they do 100-mile, you know, often there is a sort of a joke in the bicycle community, an acronym called Mammals, Middle-Aged Men, and Lycra is sort of a stereotype, that there's definitely that group. In terms of who bikes for transportation, though, I would say there's a full range. The data that I've looked at, people who are biking for transportation, it's not always for economic reasons. It's often for health reasons. It's because they find it fun and more enjoyable. Sometimes it's more reliable. So if you are in a more congested area, often you will find that if the distance is reasonable, riding your bike someplace, it's more reliable in terms of the time it takes. You're not stuck in traffic congestion, and finding parking and all that kind of stuff. And so there's a full range of why people are biking for transportation. Sometimes it is economics, that you don't have an option, but it's not always, and it sort of depends on, in the places where you are, where you have a nice bicycling infrastructure. It's often not. It's because it's a more pleasant mode. And what we found is that a lot of it has to do, people think it's fun. It makes them happy. I mean, it's often, if it's not too hard uphill, it's often just a very enjoyable experience if you have a nice, safe, like I do, a nice bike boulevard to ride on.
Other questions from the commission? All right, anyone in the audience have a question? Can please come up to the microphone so we can hear your question?
Do you mean to get on the bus? Oh, on your car. Yeah, that is a problem. I don't know if there's a good solution. We did find that in our survey. I mean, the e-bikes are heavier, and so if you ever have to lift it, either to get on a transit vehicle or your own vehicle or whatever. So it is what we have found, though, in our surveys, the nice thing, a lot of times people will want to put their bike on a car because maybe they live in a really hilly area and they need to go someplace else to ride their bike. We've definitely talked with e-bike owners who are like, I can just use my e-bike to get up the hill. I don't have to drive to go bike anymore. But yeah, that is one of the drawbacks, is the increased weight. Yeah.
Any other? Yeah.
Bike in our groups too. I didn't start until I was 67, and I've now, over 9 years, gotten over 14,000 miles on my bike. And actually, I started as a complete newbie, but loved the groups. And I now belong to 5 web groups. You know, when you sign up for them, they're free. You have access to the rides they describe, the abilities that are appropriate for this ride, the route, and how far it is. So one of the things that I just real that I really like is I found some new women's bikes for $600, $800. And they are lightweight, and they're the step-through bikes for women. And I think, personally, that one of the reasons that women don't bike more is that bikes have been really generated for men so that the distances are greater. And I think the more women who ask for bikes that are step-through and easy, to get off at a stop sign. So I just want to encourage everyone. And Susan B. Anthony, ages and ages ago, said that she felt that biking was the thing that emancipated women more than anything else in the world. And I thought that was very cool.
So, oh, yeah. No, I have a whole lecture about women and biking with us, Susan B. Anthony quotes. But, yeah, you're right. I mean, the most bikes, traditionally, they're sized for men. You walk into a bike shop, it's a bunch of dudes. Women don't feel comfortable walking in there because, but it's slowly changing. So there's many more of the step-through bikes. The other thing, when you go to Europe, like, everyone's using the step-through bikes. It's not the women. It's not the ladies' bike because it's convenient for everyone. So that's slowly changing. A little too slow, in my opinion, but it is changing, which is good.
There's a question about the style of bicycles used in Europe. The usual bicycle used for transportation is called a utility bicycle. Mm-hmm. Most of the utility bicycles are the same style. They're used over in Portland for rentals. And the reason is the utility bicycle is used when you're going out for shopping when you need to make a lot of stops. And the reason they don't have a bar is because it's much easier when you have loaded bags and so forth to get in on and off the bicycle. These bicycles are available in the United States, but the lady's correct. If you want one, you'll have to ask the bicycle shop for information on them. And the other problem is a lot of the bicycles are not made for, well, some of them are not made for women. The frame sizes are intended for children. So they either run too small or not large enough. Probably the only one I have, a utility bike, was made by Trek. But it's unique because it's a 21-inch frame. But they are available, and for people who are starting off, they'd be much better on a utility bicycle.
Thank you. Anyone else? We have time for another question. All right. Oh, okay, one more.
Went to Portland State, graduated in 1964, and I took public health studies, and I majored in chemistry and things like that. But the first person killed by a horseless carriage was in 1899. Mr. Bliss got hit. During the Vietnam War, 58,000 men died over there. During my studies at Portland State, 50,000 people a year die in traffic accidents in America. So bicycling is not the safest thing around. We should have a little caution about riding, especially today with all the cell phone usage, vaporizing, people under the influence. It's very, very dangerous out there. A car traveling 60 miles an hour is going 88 feet a second. Mm-hmm. Can you imagine that? You can't stop. By the time they hit the brakes, they're going over 100 feet. So I think we should give a little caution to how unsafe it is out there. It really is.
Thank you. Thank you. Yeah, and I think as a lot of what we've been discussing, too, is how we can create the conditions to make it safer.
Exactly. I mean, yeah, I would the protected bike lanes, separate, all of that, the idea of making it safer, and there's good evidence that those types of facilities make it safer, reducing traffic, motor vehicle traffic speeds. There's pretty good evidence, though, when you look holistically, people often look at the health benefits of bicycling, and when you do that, you do want to consider the risk that you're going to get hit and injured or killed. And in terms of overall, for adults, the evidence is pretty clear that the health benefits of biking on a regular basis outweigh the potential risk. And that also usually takes into account the air pollution that you might breathe in. I certainly wouldn't recommend biking on a day like today. But when you consider everything, that extra physical activity on a regular basis, the benefits outweigh some of those costs. But that doesn't mean we shouldn't be making our streets safer for everyone. So.
Okay, and we had one more question from the commission, and then we do need to move on to the next item in our agenda.
Thank you. One of the things I was very interested in is the concept of the barriers. I don't see that in a lot of bicycle paths at this time, but that would certainly address the safety issue. My question is there research that shows that wheelchairs, electric wheelchairs, can occupy the same bicycle paths, or is that not something you've run into?
It varies state to state what the regulations are for what types of sort of other electric assist vehicles can use bike paths, and I do not know what Washington's rules are for that, but I was just looking for Oregon because, you know, the e-scooters, you're not allowed on the sidewalk, but you're allowed in the bike path, but a Segway is allowed on the sidewalk. And so most states have particular rules for which electric-style vehicles, which, like in a scooter, electric, problem is we use the word scooter, like electric wheelchair, scooter-style wheelchair, would, I think, fall into that category. So it's another reason that we need to build this infrastructure probably big enough to accommodate those different modes.
Yeah. Great. Well, thanks. Can we please have a round of applause for Dr. Jennifer Dill? Thank you so much for being here. And now we're going to hear from the vice chair of the Clark County Bicycle and Pedestrian Advisory Committee, Michael Andriotti.
Thanks for having me here. One of the biggest problems that we as a committee have is people knowing who we are. So it's always great to be able to present ourselves to the community and to other groups so that we can have people to work with. So it's good to be here. We are the Clark Communities Bicycle and Pedestrian Advisory Committee. And the reason we're the Clark Communities Committee is because when you look at transportation as far as walking and bicycling, we can't just focus on Clark County, we have to focus on the cities within Clark County also. So while we do specifically deal with Clark County, we have to consider all communities within Clark County. So that's why we are the Clark County Community Bicycle Pedestrian Advisory Committee. So we were established in 2010 with the adoption of the Bicycle Pedestrian Master Plan that we have. So we've only been around for 8 years, so that's part of why we're not that well known. Our mission is advising the county and participating in city and state jurisdictions on matters involving bicycle and pedestrian transportation. So some of the key components of the plan is bicycle and pedestrian supportive policies. So whenever there's new policies that the county might be looking to come out with, or a member of the community wants to see something different, we can give input on those new policies or bring a concern that someone from the community has to the county to see if there's something that can't be done to change some of those policies. Looking at funding strategies for bicycle and pedestrian facilities, because a lot of times that is the biggest hurdle to clear beyond code requirements, is how are we going to fund the facility that people want. Taking an inventory of existing bicycle and pedestrian facilities, and basically you need to know where you're starting in order to know where you need to go. And so we've been looking at trying to find out where there's shortages of systems, where there's enough, and how can we connect the existing systems that we have in, you know, the best way possible for all users. We look at bicycle and we have a bicycle and sidewalk project list. Some of them have been completed, some of them hadn't. There hasn't really been a good way to determine the best projects to get implemented, and again, funding is a lot of the problem with that, or the capital improvements plan that the county has. Bicycle parking recommendations. So if, you know, a new project goes in and they need parking, we can help identify the best location for some of that parking. If some of the community sees somewhere that there needs to be bicycle parking, we can bring that concern to the county, and hopefully they can find a way to get some bicycle parking installed, stuff like that. And then a work program for plan implementation. So as a committee each year, we try to pick three or four items that we think that we can either accomplish or make progress on during that next calendar year in order to have a goal to focus on, because there are a lot of things in the master plan, and if you try to do them all at one time, you're just never going to accomplish anything. So we try to pick a few things that we can do each year and move the plan forward. Here's a list of our current committee members. Currently, we have one vacant position. We usually, I believe, open up positions around October, September, if I remember right. So if you're interested in being a part of the committee, I know we have at least one position, and I think we might have a few coming up here at the end of this year. You can find us on the Clark County website, and you can apply on there if you're interested in joining the committee. Anna and Bill are both here today as well, so that's good to see. So some of our major goals, as we talked about before, developing the bicycle pedestrian network, education, encouragement, and safety programs, and finding that funding. So for developing the bicycle pedestrian network, we helped update the Clark County bike map, and we're helping the city update their bike map right now as well. And then as on the second one there, the City of Vancouver update. And so what we do is some of us will go out, you know, we know ride in different areas, so we know if what's there, and we can say this is missing from the map, this is shown on a map but isn't actually what it's said to be. And that's one of those things that helps us identify locations where we need better facilities to be installed. We advocate for stronger transportation policies. And so, for example, when the Comprehensive Growth Management Plan update came in, you know, we can give input on the language that is being updated and say, you need to change this to focus more on pedestrians and bicyclists. You need to, you know, this is focusing too much on cars and not enough on the safety for bicycles and pedestrians. Creating a policy statement with the Clark County Department of Public Works. One of the things that we do is review public works plans to make sure that the plans that they're installing meet the requirements of the code and the safety need for pedestrians and bicyclists, and that the facilities that are supposed to be there are being installed. And they can't just say, well, we can't fund that, we're not going to put it in. You know, we're kind of holding them accountable to make sure that those facilities get installed. And if they're having a funding issue, we can work with them to try and find ways to fund that project. And then we do things like the policymakers bicycle ride last year. And while, you know, the ride was out in the City of Vancouver, and it was with a lot of City of Vancouver folks, there was Clark County folks there. And again, you know, it's the Clark community's thing. We need all of these facilities to be connected, and so when we do things like that in the city so that we can, you know, get the connections all the way through the cities and the county so that this, you know, a large interconnected network for people to use. One of the biggest things that we do and the most consistent things that we do is education, encouragement, and safety, because ultimately that's what's going to get people using the facilities the most. And once people start using the facilities, there becomes a need for the facilities, and you're more likely to get more of those facilities because they become more important. So some of the things that we do, bike safety at Ben Franklin Elementary and, you know, other elementary schools throughout. So we will partner with Bike Clark County or other groups and go to elementary schools and teach children the proper way to have a helmet on, the proper way to ride your bike, you know, signaling and those sorts of things, so that they're learning safety young when it's easier for them to take in the information and retain it and understand it. And then they can carry that safety with them throughout. And walk to school days. So you get groups of kids and you in a neighborhood and you go and walk them to school and show them the safe route to walk to school, the safe way to walk to school, so that you can get more kids walking to school. And basically instill in a young age biking and walking and the benefits of it. One good program that started a couple years ago is the Bike to Leadership program with the Vancouver School District. So for 8 weeks, some high school students work with some folks from Bike Clark County, and they learn leadership skills, job interview skills, CPR, and they do an advocacy project for that they present at the end. And Fort Vancouver did theirs. The first group was Fort Vancouver. They did theirs on bike safety after a classmate was hit by a vehicle while bicycling near the high school. So, you know, we're involved in things like that to help move along the importance of bike safety and pedestrian safety. And then last year, and you know, whenever we can, we're doing the Lights On campaign, which is an outreach campaign to make people aware that you're required by law, first of all, to have lights on your bike if you're going to ride at night, and then also the importance of having the lights on your bike at night so that you're seen by all vehicles that are on the road, that pedestrians see you, so there's no incidents when you're riding at night. A little bit more about the Light the Night campaign. We've done it a couple times now where we've gone to a movie at the park, and anyone that rides their bike that doesn't have a light, we have lights that we can put on their bike for them. We partner with Bike Clark County to do that. We helped them find some of the funding to get those lights. And so we promoted the Lights On campaign and got people, you know, safer. And we also gave out helmets at that event to people that didn't have helmets. So this is some of the project stuff that we've done. Northeast 10th Avenue from Northeast 149th Street to Northeast 154th up in Salmon Creek. They were not going to put in sidewalk and bike lanes on both sides of that road, largely due to funding, but with feedback from our committee, they took the time to find the funding, and there will be bike lanes and sidewalks on both sides of that road, so it's a safe place for people to commute. Northeast Salmon Creek Avenue, there's a lot of environmental constraints on that one. This is also up in Salmon Creek near Washington State University. And so we gave them feedback on the best way to still have bicycle and pedestrian facilities while mitigating environmental impacts. And they wanted to avoid putting in sidewalks at all, if I remember right. But we helped give feedback on a way to do it that, you know, would work best for everybody. Northeast Blair Road, if I remember right, it was on the bicycle and pedestrian plan as a major bikeway, and it came up as a striping safety project. And so it came to us to get feedback on the best way to install the striping safety for, they wanted to do raised markers along the side to keep people from driving off the side of the road. And it would be an issue for bicyclists because it's such a narrow shoulder. If there's bumps there every time, you know, if you're riding along and you hit one of those bumps, it can throw you off pretty easy. So we looked at that, and we realized that Northeast Blair Road maybe wasn't the safest place for bikes to be anyway because it's such a narrow road. And so we kind of came to a conclusion with the county and got the best situation for their striping needs and then also removed it as a priority project from the bicycle and pedestrian plan because it is such an unsafe system, and it's not on the capital improvements plan to be improved at that level in the near future. The Northeast Highway 99, so we helped pick a location for a bike repair station so that people that are riding a bike, if you have an issue, there's a repair station there that you can use to repair your bike and get back to where you're trying to go. And also along Highway 99, we gave feedback on the protected bike lane that's out there by Fred Meyer now. They installed it, I believe, at the beginning of the summer. And I rode those bike lanes prior to the separation and after, and all it is a stripe line, you know, two stripe lines. I think it's only a foot, maybe 2 feet wide. It's amazing the difference that little buffer makes as far as how safe I felt being on that road when I was riding. And then we work with the Transportation Alternative Program. One of our members is involved in the application review and project recommendations for funding through the TAP program. Another thing we were involved in was the selection of where new sidewalks would be put. So they've got a scoring criteria to determine where, you know, if there's five sidewalk projects, they have to decide which one to fund. There needs to be a scoring system to get the best one in. And so we helped update that system to make sure that there was an equitable amount of sidewalks being put in the right places. And there wasn't just, you know, people that necessarily don't advocate for themselves missing out on things because they didn't know any better sort of situation. So we're involved in trying to make sure that there are sidewalks where there really needed to be and not just put in because there happens to be a group that's more vocal than another group, even if they're not necessarily needed in that location. Oh, I hit the wrong button. There we go. And then we do a lot of outreach, again, to get ourselves known so that people in the community know that they can come to us with issues and we can take them to the county. We did an outreach at the fair. Myself and Anna, another committee member, sat at a trailhead on the Burnt Bridge Creek Trail just to say hi to people, give out maps of the system, and let them know who we were and see if anyone had any concerns. And then we've had a booth at the Earth Day Festival the last couple of years just to talk to people. And we worked with Clark College to get a logo so that we had something to identify ourselves with so people could really know who we are. And we've also worked with Clark College students to create a bike safety quiz. It's about 50% complete right now. We're trying to get them to pick the project back up again so it can get finished. But basically, it's a quiz for kids, adults, and I think they have it for bicyclists. There's like four different quizzes, and you take the quiz, and you get a little certificate at the end once you've completed it, and you can see how many you got right, how many you got wrong. And it's a great way to educate people on how to bike safely, how to drive safely, and how to walk safely all together on the same roads. And then a couple of the other projects we worked on, the Washington State Department of Transportation Corridor. So on 500, we gave a lot of feedback on that Stapleton 54th Avenue work that they're going to be doing and getting pedestrians across that road and, you know, safety for all modes of transportation. And then working to help with this grant application for Highway 99 at 99th Street, detaching the sidewalk and getting a bike lane in there and getting that intersection a little bit safer for people going through there. And then we also do committee bike rides once in a while to keep ourselves familiar with the system since we don't all ride in the same location. And it's a fun way for us to get out and see the community. And then funding, that's a tough one for us. We work on it all the time, but the biggest one that we've done is assisting Bike Clark County in getting the lights for the Lights On campaign. And so right now in our work plan, we're working to audit our arterial atlas to ensure that bike lanes are aligned with the identified bike roads in the plan, to conduct an operational review to see where improvements are needed in bike lanes and also in parking, because a lot of the issue we have is cars parking in bike lanes. And then we're going to begin a Share the Path program or campaign over the next year to help educate people on safe ways to use multi-use paths, because if you don't feel safe using it, you're not going to use it. So we want to make sure everyone knows how to use them properly. So that's who we are.
Great. Thank you. And because we are running a little over on time, we have time for one question, Amy.
Thank you for your presentation. I'm just kind of mesmerized by your passion for the topic. When I drive home, I'm going to be going north on Fruit Valley, and there's a couple of curves where it says on the road, bicycles can use the whole lane.
Yes.
And then I read something, I think, in the Columbian that's going to be changed somehow. Can you tell me what the plan is for that? Is it to widen the road or get rid of cars? Or?
I don't know what the plan is for that one specifically. Most likely to widen the road.
Okay. I can answer that.
There you go.
And too bad Anna left, because she could probably answer that as well. You're probably talking about the Fruit Valley Road Bridge over the railroad. Which, remember that 12-mile ride I told you about in the work session? That was one of the routes that we rode the bikes on for the city's policymakers ride. That eventually there is a study looking at a new 26th Avenue extension that would bypass Fruit Valley Road. And as part of that project, that would replace that bridge with bike lanes and walkways so that pedestrians and bikes don't have to use the traffic lanes and share it with trucks. So that eventually will happen. It's a funding issue.
This worries me.
I've ridden that section before. It's interesting.
Well, as a automobile driver, I get kind of nervous that I'm going to probably smash into four
Michael, thank you.
Thank you.
And we just have a couple of small pieces here left. Our next meeting is September 18th, and we're going to hear from Gary Pagenstecker, who's a planner with the city of Tigard, and he's going to talk about community design and how Tigard is working on its plan to become the most walkable community in the Pacific Northwest. So we're looking forward to hear about land use from him. And then we also had the one piece of business, Chuck.
Yes, thank you. During our work session, we heard from county staff on proposed changes to the county code to address manufactured housing and mobile home code updates, and some of them were required under being consistent with state law. Some of them were to recognize the kind of leveling the playing field for manufactured housing as well, compared to stick-built housing. But the key that I came out of that, the code changes, were looking at ways to also make the housing a little bit more affordable, including consideration of upgrades in how manufactured homes are look and built, as well as mobile homes, what we call, heard about the park model, where somebody who is a snowbird who lives up here can move their home down to Arizona during the winter and still be consistent and compliant with county code and state code. And so I would like to make a motion to propose that our chair write a letter to the county council, who will be taking this matter up in September, supporting the code changes that we discussed in the meeting, understanding that we also will hear from the discussion that there were a few concerns about these codes or about other elements that could be addressed. And so I'd like to open that motion or make that motion for that letter.
We have a second?
Second.
And any discussion? All right. All in favor?
Aye.
Aye.
All opposed? All right, motion carries. We will write a letter. And although we are running over, I want to remind everybody about the Walk to End Alzheimer's on Sunday, September 9th. And if there is public comment, we do still want to take it. So if anybody has any public comment, please come to the mic. All right, everybody just wants to go home. Meeting is adjourned. Thank you.